Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Theater of Ideas at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics here in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. My name is Julie Wright. I'm the coordinator of the Waterloo Global Science Initiative. It's my pleasure to welcome you to the second of three public lectures that we're presenting this week as part of our Equinox Summit Energy 2030. Before we begin, I just have a couple of announcements I want to get through. And one is that this lecture will run approximately 1 hour, followed by a question and answer session. And now is an excellent time to turn off any mobile devices that you may have with you here in the theater. This event is streaming live and is being recorded for future broadcast as well. WGSI would like to acknowledge TVO, our presenting media partner, for their efforts in bringing these lectures and the events all this week to you online and on TV. There are several more interesting lectures and panel discussions coming up this week, including the agenda with Steve Paikin each evening, broadcast here from our theater. And if you can't be here in the audience, you can always tune in online at tvo.org or wgsi.org. Today's Equinox Summit public lecture features Dr. Thomas Homer Dixon on the topic of energy, complexity, and human survival. Thomas Homer Dixon holds the CG Chair of Global Systems at the Balsillie School of International Affairs here in Waterloo, Canada, and he's a professor at the University of Waterloo. His research areas include the links between environmental stress and violence in developing nations, global security in the 21st century, and how societies adapt to economic, ecological, and technological change. He's also the author of a number of books, including The Ingenuity Gap, Carbon Shift, and The Upside of Down. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Thomas Homer Dixon.
Thank you very much, Julie. It's marvelous to be with you this afternoon and to see a full house, a big audience to have a conversation about really some of the most challenging issues that humankind faces right now. The summit process, the Equinox Summit and the Perimeter Institute have brought together a really quite extraordinary group of experts to think about humankind's energy problem and try to identify plausible pathways forward or solutions to the challenges we face. Now, the relationship between energy and society is something that I have considered for many years, going back really to my undergraduate days. Some 30 years ago, more than 30 years ago, I started to think about the role of energy in societies. And I've reflected a lot on that relationship, and I've, of course, read a lot. And I wanted to provide today an overview of some of the key issues that I think are at the heart of that relationship between energy and society, especially, in particular, this relationship between energy and complexity, and why, in some respects, that relationship means that we can only get so far with conservation and demand-side measures. In other words, if we want to have the kind of complex social and technological and economic systems that we have in our societies today and that provide us with many benefits, we actually need to have a lot of energy. And there is a certain irreducible demand if we want to sustain that complexity. And that's one of the conclusions that's coming out of the research that I and others have been doing over the last number of years. So I have a lot of material to cover, and I'm going to go quite quickly, and I'm looking forward to our Q&A period after this presentation. I'm going to start very large, sort of looking at the macro aspects of humankind. And one of the things that's most noticeable about the trajectory of development of the human species over the last couple of millennia, as you see with this chart on the human population, is the extraordinary period of human population growth in the last century, century and a half or so. And what you see here, the timeline across the bottom from roughly zero year of the current era up to the present time, and then on the vertical axis, you have billions of people. And right now, currently, we're just below 7 billion people on the planet. You take the 20th century. The 20th century was a period of quite remarkable growth in the human population. It quadrupled in size. We went from 1.5 billion people to 6 billion people on the planet. During that period of time, humankind was also able to increase its agricultural productivity, its output of wheat, corn, of rice, oats, and barley, of the main grains that we eat, about fourfold. So we were able to multiply the productivity of our farming about fourfold, the amount that we produce per hectare. The increase in the energy input during that period of time, from 1900 to 2000, was 80-fold. That's 80. For fertilizer, for mechanization, for irrigation, for transportation. What we learned to do in the 20th century to a large extent, and this is a major reason for the human population growth, is we learned to drill into the ground, extract petroleum and natural gas, convert it into food, and eat the food. If it weren't for those extraordinarily abundant sources of energy in the 20th century during the height of the oil age, what will be eventually known as the oil age, the human population would be vastly smaller than it is right now. In fact, quite possibly half the size. So energy, the availability of large amounts of cheap energy during the last century or century and a half has fundamentally shaped the human prospect. Now, I'm particularly interested in the relationship between energy and complexity, and as I set that argument up, it's important to realize that the best way of thinking about energy, in a sense, is as a master resource. So we have resources like water and iron ore and copper ore, but the one thing that we need most of all, if we want to do just about anything, is energy. In fact, if we have lots of energy, we often are able to substitute a relatively abundant resource for another rarer resource because we can use the energy to convert one resource into another or manipulate in some way so that it provides the service that the rarer resource provides. So energy, in many respects, is the most important resource on this planet, if you want to think of all the different sources of energy as in aggregate as one kind of resource. But we tend to have a fairly limited understanding. I think the lay or the popular understanding, and even within our policymaking and political elites, the popular understanding of energy is really pretty limited. We think of it as a fuel for our cars, perhaps to heat our homes, for our machinery to keep our economy going. We think of energy heating things up and making things move. But the argument I'm going to make today is that really, more fundamentally, energy is an enabler of complexity. It allows us to have complex institutions and complex technologies. Now, the deep reason for that relationship between energy and complexity is something that I won't go into, and it's not fully understood. But it does generally appear to be the case that as things become more complex, they require more energy to make and to sustain, to keep them running. So that's the issue I'm going to focus on in my presentation. And in the first part of my presentation, I'm going to look at this complexity issue. And then in the second part of my presentation, I'll look at energy. So I'm going to start with complexity. What is it? What causes it? How do we recognize it, as we see here? Is it a good thing or a bad thing? And then I'm going to turn to the energy issue and look at the relationship between energy and complexity. So how do we recognize complexity? I have a list of things in this slide that suggests we should look for. To a certain extent, you can go and you can sort of check the boxes and you say, well, we've got this and this and this, and therefore we're looking at something that's complex. And I'm using complex in a technical sense, not in the sense of complicated. Complex systems have behaviors that are different from simple systems, things that you could say characterize as simple machines. So complex systems will tend to have many components. That seems pretty straightforward. There'll be high connectivity between those components, either in terms of material flows, energy flows between those components, or in terms of information. There will be nonlinearity in the system, and that's a more technical notion, but generally it means that there's a disproportionality between cause and effect. Small events in a complex system can have big consequences, and sometimes big events don't have much consequence at all. You can imagine what problems that creates for predicting and managing the behavior of a complex system. And we look around us, we look at ecological systems, at electrical grids. A few years ago, a tree branch fell across a high-voltage power line in Ohio. A relatively small perturbation in the grid, but all of a sudden, 30 million people were without power in northeastern North America. A relatively small portion of the world economy, the subprime housing market in the United States, goes into crisis, and before we know it, the entire world economy is in crisis. These are situations where relatively small things are causing enormous impacts. Similarly, though, we see occasions where sometimes very big things don't seem to produce much change at all. So this is a fundamental characteristic of nonlinear behavior in complex systems. Emergence. A complex system exhibits emergent properties. When you put all its pieces together, it starts to do things that you wouldn't have expected and can't really understand just by looking at the individual components. Now, when you put a car together, you can understand the behavior of the automobile engine by looking at the individual components. But frequently what happens with a complex system, an ecological system, an economy, perhaps that electrical grid again, is that you put the bits and pieces together and it starts to exhibit novel behavior, behavior that you wouldn't have anticipated. And that's what specialists mean by emergence. And then the final characteristic that's critical for complex systems in this list, and I could actually make a bigger list, but this is not a bad place to start, is thermodynamic openness. And by this, simply mean that complex systems require large inputs of high-quality energy in order to sustain their coherence and their functions, and to basically hold themselves together. And they draw that energy in from external systems. They are voraciously energy hungry. And as they become more complex, they need more high-quality energy. In some ways, we can think about this in terms of this bowl metaphor that I have here in this slide. The idea is that as a complex system, your economy or your society or your organization or your institution or your technological system becomes more complex, it's like you're pushing that marble up the side of the bowl. And as you push it up the side of the bowl, you have to work harder to hold it there, which is an input of energy. And if you take the energy away, the ball rolls back down to the bottom of the bowl to a position of thermodynamic equilibrium. You're holding it up the side of the bowl in disequilibrium. You're holding it away from equilibrium. And you have to work to hold it there. You need energy to hold it there. You take your finger away or your thumb away, and the marble rolls back down to the bottom of the bowl because that's really where it wants to be. And in social terms, if you take the energy away, that's a process of decomplexification. We can't sustain our complex institutions, our complex technologies, our complex social arrangements without those inputs of energy. And I think it helps to keep that bowl metaphor in mind when you think about the requirement for energy inputs to maintain complexity. So with that as background in terms of how we recognize complexity, in a sense, what is complexity, let's talk a little bit about what causes complexity. And very simply, as you see in this slide, in human systems, social, economic, technological systems, we introduce complexity to solve our problems. We use complexity to deal with whatever the problem might be. We don't have enough water. We develop technologies to drill deeper or pump water from some other place so that we can get the water we need. We can't grow enough food. We need to protect our soils. We develop technologies to conserve soils, perhaps building platforms and with little buns and things to keep the soil in place. And each one of these moves is an increase in the technological complexity of a society. And we do these things not because we just like things to be more complex, but because we want to solve the problems we face. And of course, you can imagine that as things get really complex, as we see in our societies today, the complexity we introduce actually generates more problems that we then have to use more complexity to solve. So, for instance, in the recent financial crisis, we saw a whole series of new economic instruments and assets like collateralized debt obligations and structured investment vehicles and credit default swaps, which really only a very few people in the world understand. But to deal with the consequences of those new assets, which almost wiped out the world economy, we found out, to our great expense, we've had to introduce yet more complexity in the form of regulations and rules to govern the trading of those assets and how they're going to be created and used within our economy. If you want to get more specific about what causes complexity and what the actual consequences are in our societies, I would say if I were going to point to one set of phenomena that has really boosted complexity in the last few decades, 2 to 3 decades, it would be advances in information technology that have multiplied ferociously the rate at which we can transfer enormous quantities of information, not just over short distances, but potentially around the planet. And we've also seen, of course, steady performance improvements at the level of system units in terms of how organizations operate and how technologies operate. And you can see that in every component of your, or every aspect of your lives. Many of you probably have low-flow toilets. They're pretty well de rigueur now. Sometimes I think I should actually have the guts of an old-style toilet and a new one so I can compare them, actually show audiences, but I thought that would be a little bit distasteful. But it's very interesting to look at the difference. You remember those old toilets, you could fix them yourself, right? You could, if it wasn't working properly, you took off the back and you looked inside and you bent the bar or put some glue on the little ball, the float ball or something, and made it work. And now you open the thing up and you can't really understand exactly why it's working a lot of the time, and you actually sometimes have to replace whole components. You just take something out and get another component in, put another component in, and those components are very carefully designed. If you look at them carefully, they're much more complex than the old components, and they probably involve lots of very fancy computer-assisted design and calculations involving fluid dynamics and turbulence to make them work just right. Well, one of the things I noticed, just as an aside about these new low-flow toilets, is that they break a lot, and when they break a lot, I can't fix them. And because I have to get somebody in to actually replace the pieces, a plumber, the thing is often sitting there leaking for a long time, wasting all the water, of course, that I saved by having the low-flow toilet in the first place. So the point of this little anecdote is that we're actually surrounded by increasing complexity, whether it's in our cars or in our kitchens or in our bathrooms. And you have to raise some real questions ultimately about whether it's really contributing to our well-being and the greater good in our lives. Overall, I'd say if you want to think in terms of networks, all of these changes that I'm talking about are contributing to economic and social networks within our societies, within our communities, within our larger societies, and around the world that have these three particular characteristics that you see here. There are more nodes, and the nodes can be people. They can be individual technologies, like a computer sitting on your desk. It can be an organization, maybe even a whole society. But something that you would treat as sort of a node within a network. More links to other nodes in that network. Much higher density of links than we have seen in previous generations, and especially much more rapid movement of material, energy, and information across those links between the nodes. Now, we can ask some questions, ultimately, about, and I've raised this question already with my anecdote about the low-flow toilet, about whether all of this rising social, economic, and technological complexity is a good thing or a bad thing. And I'm going to contrast the good and the bad for a few minutes. A good thing? Well, undoubtedly it is. Otherwise, we wouldn't be producing it. Complexity often helps us solve our problems, as I indicated before. It can be source, and that, so that's point number one. Complexity can also be a source of innovation, because it turns out that those who study innovation, whether it's in ecological systems, evolutionary systems, within economies, or in a local community group, innovation invariably involves combinations of things that would not otherwise have been brought into contact or would have not otherwise intersected with each other. Novel combinations of people, of ideas, of bits of technology that are brought together and people say, oh, wow, this is interesting, this helps solve that problem. And so complex systems, because they increase the rate at which you see this interaction of novel things together in novel ways, often are much more innovative overall than simple systems, because they increase the rate at which you get novel combinations. And complex systems, to the extent that they are diverse, that they have diversity of all their components, that they're not homogenized, that within an economy or within a society it's complex and it has lots of different kinds of people and organizations and groups and communities, linguistic groups, cultures, etc. And to the extent that a complex system provides for distributed problem solving, a good example would be a modern market, for example, where you have lots of different businesses and firms all trying to solve problems in their own way, you find that both of those things, the diversity and the distributed problem solving, produce an enormous boost for adaptability. Complex systems tend to be much more adaptive to rapidly changing external environments. So these are reasons why complexity is a good thing. But there are also, as I suggested, reasons why complexity is a bad thing. And I'm being really simple about it here, but it's worth getting some of these things out, at least a first-order, simplistic way of presenting this sort of balance between the good and the bad. First is that, just like with that low-flow toilet, I look at this thing, and I can't understand it. It's opaque to me. I can't even take it apart properly. And whether that's your world economy or the guts of your low-flow toilet, in both cases, that opacity, because we can't see how the system's working inside, leads to a lot of uncertainty about how it's going to behave, this thing, under different circumstances, because we don't have a full understanding of it. Because of that non-linearity characteristic I mentioned before, complex systems can often exhibit threshold behavior. They can flip from one state to another state, often without much warning at all. It can be very surprising. There were very few people that predicted the collapse of the East Coast fishery or the recent financial crisis. It's always easy to say, oh, well, I knew that was going to happen after the fact. But before the fact, there are actually very few people who predicted it, because no one really had a sufficient understanding of all the internal connections within the system to know what was going to push the economy or the ecology over a threshold into a new state. So threshold behavior is often a bad thing because it makes management of complex systems very difficult. Managerial overload. People, you go and talk to public servants, especially senior ones, deputy ministers and the like, and they're just pulling their hair out because all of the tools that they were taught and they've learned over the decades for how we operate in our world don't seem to be very helpful anymore. And they're constantly feeling that they're completely overloaded by all kinds of surprises and events that are coming at them from every direction. Often in the form of cascading failures, complex systems are frequently tightly coupled, like that electricity grid. You pop one part of it out and you find that you get like a row of dominoes falling over, you get problems cascading away, and 30 million people are without power, or we go from the subprime market in the United States to a global economic crisis. Again, characteristic of complex systems. And then finally, brittleness. And brittleness is something I want to spend a little bit more time on because it's very important. You'll hear conversations in this event and many other events about the importance of reducing brittleness, of increasing what's called resilience, which is the capacity to bounce back from a shock. Frequently, complex systems get to a point where they're not very resilient, where you hit them and for a variety of reasons, they stop functioning or they have catastrophic breakdown, especially when they get to be too complex. Now, brittleness arises for a number of reasons, and I'm not going to go into all of these reasons in great detail here, but generally, as systems become really, really complex, again, whether your economy or Canadian society or a healthcare system, or perhaps a particular technology you're working with, such as your computer or something, but if you think in terms of the economy more generally, which is a useful example, as they become too complex, they actually start to lose their ability to exploit potential for novelty, to innovate, for reasons that I'm not going to go into here, but it turns out that that's pretty clear. They become more likely to experience those cascading failures that I talked about, like rows of dominoes falling over. They also, and I'm going to mention this a little bit more in a moment, have a declining redundancy of critical components. And this is happening around us today. Some of the things that we depend upon most in our complex systems are becoming less redundant, and therefore the systems are becoming less resilient. And then finally, as you see in this slide, we're getting a rise in brittleness. And this is, now we're linking complexity with energy again, because of the enormous energy requirements that are required to maintain our global technologies and societies far from equilibrium while they're trying to deal with a whole range of systemic stresses from food production, climate change, to fundamentally providing more energy for humankind. Moment, just talk a bit about this loss of redundancy and what it means in practical terms. Here's a list of examples. If we're looking at the global economy, Václav Smil was here yesterday. He's provided most of these examples. Within the global economy, we're seeing a loss, or what you might say, a concentration of the production of critical goods and services within relatively small number of firms. And that's partly a result of the very tight connectivity in the global economy, and a lot of second order and third order producers and firms just are shaken out. They lose market share and eventually disappear, and only the big guys are left. And as a result, as we see in this list, just for viewers, I'm going to read it quickly. Two companies make all large jetliners in the world. Three companies make all jet engines. Four companies make 95% of microprocessors. Three companies sell 60% of all tires. Two manufacturers press bottles, right? 66% of the world's glass bottles, only two. One company produces the machines. This is one company in Germany that makes 80% of the world's spark plugs. So it produces the machines, the machine tools that then make the spark plugs. So just as we would find in an ecology, where you have a concentration or a reliance of an ecological system like a forest on certain keystone species, and you knock out that keystone species because it gets a disease or something that largely wipes out the species, and that has a really big effect, perhaps a catastrophic effect on the overall ecology, the overall forest. In the same sort of way, we're finding, and it's interesting how we're seeing some of these developments with the recent catastrophe in Japan, certain key producers are knocked out, and we find that it has, again, cascading effects through the whole economy. It's like keystone species being knocked out in the ecology, keystone firms that produce critical components for the world economy, and now there's only one or two firms doing it. You lose it, and it has a huge effect on the overall economy. That's a loss of overall resilience. Okay, so we've looked at the good, and we've looked at the bad. Now let's bring the two things together. And here I'm going to be drawing on the work of Joseph Tainter, who I think is really one of the most insightful folks in this business, an anthropologist who wrote a book I'd highly recommend, published in 1998, The Collapse of Complex Societies. The argument I'm going to give you over the next few minutes is largely drawn from that book, although with certain Homer Dixon modifications. And Joe suggests that systems get more complex over time, societies get more complex over time, just in the way I've described, but eventually it doesn't really contribute very much. There's a declining marginal social return to complexity, and by marginal, for those of you who aren't economists, it means like that last increment of complexity is now not giving you as much as the previous increment of complexity in terms of increased well-being for the society. And at some point, as you can see in this particular slide, you go over the top and you actually get negative returns. The complexity is actually degrading your well-being. Every extra increment of complexity is making things worse and worse for you. So Tainter's argument, if you wanted to strip it down to its bare essentials, is summarized on this slide, that societies become inexorably more complex as they try to solve their problems. We've already been through that point. This complexity costs energy, and I've discussed that already. And over time, complexity produces diminishing returns. Now, Joe, I think, actually has been remarkably insightful in developing this argument, but he could actually push it further. And so if I were to unpack it, I would unpack it in terms of this ratio, that the marginal social return on complexity is this ratio between benefit and cost, is a function of this ratio between benefit and cost. The benefit derived from that extra increment of complexity divided by the cost of that increment of complexity. And Joe is actually making two arguments simultaneously, and I don't think he makes these as distinct as he could in his work. He's suggesting that the numerator, the top part of this ratio, is declining at the same time as the denominator, the bottom part of this ratio, is rising. And the reason the bottom part is rising is because of rising energy costs. And that brings us to energy. So just to summarize, Tainter is actually making two critical arguments about changing marginal social return to complexity. The first is that the benefit derived from that extra increment of complexity is dropping. And the second is that the cost per unit of energy is rising. And that's because of a declining energy return on investment. So that's the complexity part of my argument. I'm now going to turn to the energy part of my argument to show why I think Tainter is right, that energy is becoming more expensive. And so the cost of that input into the ratio in the denominator is rising. And so overall, you have a declining return on complexity to our societies. I should say, just to go back, that this is an oil rig that I worked on in the early part of the 1970s. It looks like it's from the 1920s, but I'm not actually that old. And there I am on that rig back in 1974, I think. The reason I've shown this photograph is because in many respects, the challenge we face is being caused, of course, by our climate crisis, but also because oil is becoming harder to get. And oil is spectacularly important for our well-being as a global civilization, for humankind's well-being. And I don't think most people realize just how significant oil is, how remarkable it is. It provides about 40% of the world's commercial energy. It provides 98% of the world's transportation energy. It's the stuff that the world's economy literally runs on. Three tablespoons of crude oil provide as much free energy as would be expended by an adult male laborer in a day's labor. Every time you fill up the gas tank of a standard North American car, you're putting the equivalent of 2 years of manual labor into that gas tank. And we can see the importance of these energy sources from this kind of graph, which shows It's a graph of the volumetric density, megajoules per liter, how much energy per liter of whatever this thing is, this substance, against the gravimetric density, megajoules per kilogram of this substance. And we can see that diesel and biodiesel and gasoline have great volumetric density. They're right at the top of the scale. That means you pack a lot of energy into a very small space, which is very important for transportation because you don't want to have great big fuel tanks in whatever vehicle you're trying to move around. It may be that petroleum is just about the finest energy source we're ever going to find on this planet, and we are consuming it at a phenomenal rate. There are three key facts that we have to keep in mind with respect to liquid fuels or petroleum on the planet. First of all, higher oil prices spur exploration. They encourage people to send rigs out to drill more holes in the ground to look for oil. But they don't actually seem to be related very much to discovery. We drill a lot of holes, but frequently we don't find very much. In fact, the biggest discoveries in the past all occurred during periods of time when oil prices were relatively low. Second point, about 60% of the fields in the world, the oil-producing fields in the world, are now post-peak production and starting to decline, 60%. The average decline rate for those fields is estimated to be between 6 and 9%. So if you want to maintain global production of crude oil, you have to compensate for that decline first and foremost before you can even think about, say, increasing the production to meet increased demand in places like India and China. And that's all summarized in the last statement on this slide, that to cover this decline in the mature fields and meet a modest increase in demand, we need 64 million barrels per day of additional oil production capacity by 2030, which is about six times the output of Saudi Arabia. And we need to bring 30 million barrels per day online in just 4 years from now. So when you go and talk to what usually are fairly conservative energy analysts, such as these folks at the Energy Information Administration in the United States, who folks there and in Paris at the International Energy Agency, who were very, very reluctant to utter the phrase peak oil 5 years ago, even 3 years ago, they're now starting to recognize we actually have a real problem. And they're starting to produce analyses such as this. And there you see, as we go out towards 2030, that gap of roughly 60 million barrels a day of production. Across the bottom, we have from 2008 to 2030 or so. On the left-hand axis, we have millions of barrels per day. Our current production is around 87. One of my students who's here today told me it was 87.5 million barrels yesterday that we produced around the world. We've been hanging out at around 85 to 90 million barrels a day for a number of years. There seems to be some resistance at that level. It's turning out to be hard to get above that level. But the projection is, if you look at the blue line there going up into the future, that especially because of Chinese and Indian energy consumption, we're going to be looking at increase towards 100, 110, perhaps 120 million barrels a day of demand by 2030. And what these folks at the Energy Information Administration have done is they've looked at all the existing fields in the world and production processes, and they've looked at all the ones that are expected to come online in the future, including future oil sands in Alberta, and projected into the future, and they still have, in 2030, a 60 million barrel a day gap. That's a big deal. Now, you might think, well, the tar sands, oil sands, will take care of that in Alberta. Slight slip there. Well, let's take a look very quickly where the oil sands fall appear. If you look, and I can't do this with a pointer, and I have to explain this for the people on TV, but if you look at the second, on the left-hand side, at the second narrow line, you see a thin blue band there. So you've got the blue line on top, which is demand, and then you've got a green band underneath that, and then a light blue band. So the second blue band, and below that is the purple one. That second blue band is oil sands in Canada right now. As we go out into the future, you see that an orangey-yellow band develops above it. That's future oil sands production. And if you go out to 2030, that gives us about 5 million barrels a day. Now, let's put this in perspective. We're going to spend $200 billion on oil sands development in Alberta by 2030, an enormous amount of capital, in order to produce 5 million barrels a day, which is basically about half of Saudi Arabia's current production. The oil sands are not going to save the day when it comes to liquid fuels on this planet. Now, a critical part of this story about the challenge we face with respect to oil is this issue of energy return on investment, which I alluded to a moment ago. Producing energy costs energy. You dig down to the ground, you've got to drive those drill rigs, you've got to refine the stuff. This all takes energy. And so what you can do, quite reasonably, is you can look at the ratio between energy input and energy output. Actually, let's put it the other way around. Energy output divided by energy input. In the 1930s in Texas, drillers got about 100 barrels of oil back for every barrel of oil of energy they invested to drill down into the ground and pump oil out. Now, the energy return on investment in the United States for conventional oil is around 17 to 1 and falling. For the oil sands in Alberta, the energy return on investment is 4 to 1. For corn-based ethanol fuels, the energy return on investment is about 1 to 1. So you put about as much energy in as you get out. It's a great subsidy for farmers, but it's an atrocious energy technology. And this issue of the energy return on investment turns out to be a fundamental constraint on human, social, and physical, and technological, and economic development, and our capacity to expand the complexity of our societies. We're entering a transition from a regime of abundant, high-quality, high energy return on investment energy, in particular carbon fuels, in particular oil, to one of abundant, we still got lots of coal, mixed quality, mixed energy return on investment energy. Coal still gives us a good energy return on investment, up to 80 to 1, but other sources of energy now that we're going to have to move to aren't so good when it comes to the EROI. And that's represented in this diagram, which has a lot of information on it, but it actually is very helpful and not anywhere near as hard as it looks at first glance. Across the bottom, we have the contribution of this particular energy source to the American economy overall in terms of quadrillion British thermal units per year. So we go from 0 to 110. And then on the vertical axis, we have our energy return on investment from 0 to 1 to 100 to 1. And what I want you to look at here is the trajectory of domestic oil production in the United States. From 1930, you see the little balloon at the top there near 100 to 1, providing about 5 quads per year to the American economy with an energy return on investment of 100 to 1. In 1970, providing perhaps 25 quads to the American economy, but an energy return on investment has dropped to about 30 to 1. And now, because of oil depletion in the United States, providing somewhere around 13 quads, quadrillion British thermal units to the American economy with an energy return on an investment of around 15 to 17 to 1. And this is an inexorable physical problem. And it's something that tends to get overlooked when we consider our energy challenges. Take a quick look at some of the other sources of energy there. Hydro gives us a pretty good energy return on investment of around 30 to 1. Wind, 20 to 1. Nuclear, depends on how you calculate it, and there's a big debate, but it's not terrific, probably in the neighborhood of 10 to 20 to 1. You can see when you fall below 10 to 1, there's some speculation that you actually can't maintain a complex civilization at that point because you don't have sufficient energy excess after you've actually produced energy to sustain the complexity of a society, a modern society. Photovoltaics, PV, you see there, below 10 to 1. A great deal of controversy about that. Every time I show this, when there's some solar folks in the room, they are deeply annoyed. But nonetheless, I think it's a real challenge for the renewables industry. So let's think about this diagrammatically in terms of the relationship between the energy we use to maintain complexity and the energy we need to get energy. Now, in previous years, and this is very simple and schematic in this representation, we have a circle in the middle. It's the energy that we need to maintain our social complexity. And we need a certain amount of energy to generate that energy, and that's represented by the blue band around it. And the two things together make up total energy consumption. Well, that may be where we were, but as our energy return on investment is falling for critical energy sources, that blue band has to expand. Maybe we can keep the central part constant, but to maintain the production of sufficient energy to maintain complexity and keep that central part constant, we have to expand the blue band. So our total energy consumption has to go up overall. Maybe we can do that. I would argue, though, that there are probably limits to the extent to which we can expand that total energy envelope while maintaining the amount of energy, the inputs of energy into our societies and economies and technologies to maintain their function and their complexity. And I think the limits of expansion of the total energy consumption, total energy production, will be determined in part by resource availability around the world and in part by capital constraints. It starts to get so expensive in terms of building the machinery and the production facilities to extract low-quality energy from places like northern Alberta that eventually it's going to simply become too expensive for us in terms of the draw on the overall economy and the capital requirements from the overall economy to produce the energy we need. And what will happen at that point is that we have to shrink the center. We have to start reducing the amount of energy that is available for maintaining societal complexity. So, in this new world, what do we do? You might all feel remarkably depressed at this point, and I have to admit that I have a reputation at this point for people wanting to run out and go screaming into the hills. But it's really at the point of the exercise that we're engaged in here at the Equinox Summit is to show that this is really a tractable problem in many respects. And I'm not going to go through all the solutions and the kind of energy transition we're thinking of looking at over the next generation or two. It's going to be a remarkable transformation of our societies. That's an exercise that Vaclav yesterday and David Keith tomorrow will discuss, and the folks at the Equinox Summit are working on right now. But the solutions will fall probably more or less into these categories. I call this we can cope with carbon, because the larger problem in some respects that we're trying to deal with is carbon emissions. And to cope with carbon, to make sure that we don't wreck our climate, we're probably going to have a price on the emission of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. In other words, we're going to have to start paying for using the atmosphere as a garbage dump for our carbon dioxide. And given that there's a price on carbon, we're going to see really quite profound shifts in the character of energy production in our societies. The first three lines there, I call my 30-30-40 solution. This is without any new kinds of technology, without the folks at the Equinox Summit saying, this is the silver bullet, this is what we're going to do to solve this problem. Just with what we have on the shelf right now, we can probably get 30% from efficiency and conservation. But given that we need to sustain complexity, there is a limit below which we cannot go in terms of reducing energy inputs to modern, highly complex societies. We can probably get another 30% or so from distributed renewables, especially wind and solar, depending on a good match between the end-use service that those distributed renewables are providing and the character of the technology. I'm not convinced that enormous wind farms and enormous solar farms are the way we're going to generate huge amounts of power for our civilizations in the future, and we can talk about that in Q&A if you like. And then for the interim period, we're probably going to have to generate about 40%, the residual 40% of our energy as electricity with centralized power production in capital-intensive installations, big power plants, and the power will be distributed through the grid. We'll probably end up electrifying much of our transportation system, so we'll be running our transportation system off the grid, our private cars, for example. And that power will be produced, I think, probably for several decades, principally by coal and natural gas with carbon capture and storage, pumping the carbon dioxide underground. Well, that may get us a few decades out, but we're still going to need to develop new zero-carbon technologies, such as underground coal gasification, stratospheric windmills, and my particular favorite, enhanced or ultra-deep geothermal, which is where you go 8-10 kilometers underground, you heat up water to 300 or 400 degrees Celsius, you bring it up to the surface, use it to drive turbines, and then pump it back down to heat up again. And potentially that's a technology that's usable everywhere in the world, and it has very high power density and potentially a very good return on investment, energy return on investment. And I'm not going to talk about the last two items on that slide. The bottom line, though, is that we need to get ready for what you might call a general purpose technology transition. This is what economists call a GPT transition. And there have been some big ones in the past. The introduction of railroads in the 19th century, the electrification of our economies, the introduction of the internal combustion engine, the introduction of the personal computer more recently, and perhaps in the future, a wave of new green energy technologies. This will actually quite possibly be a bigger GPT transition than all of the previous ones, because we're probably going to have to introduce a suite of new technologies, not just a single new one. And in every one of those previous cases, there has been a tidal wave of creative destruction that has swept across the economy as old sclerotic industries have declined and gone bankrupt and been displaced by the new technology, and new industries have developed. And this has provided extraordinary opportunities for entrepreneurship and for investment and for profit and a surge of innovation within our economies. And I see every reason to believe that that is possible now. This could potentially be an extraordinarily exciting time for inventors and for capitalists and for business people and for people who want to engage with the very most significant problems humankind is facing. In my last few minutes, though, I want to say something about how I think this transition is going to unfold. And I'm going to go fairly quickly through this because I only have a couple of minutes now. Getting through this general purpose technology transition, it's not going to be a smooth process. It's going to be characterized by shocks and crises, which I'll say more in a moment. Pricing is key, as I indicated. We have to get the prices right for energy, otherwise entrepreneurs won't have the incentive to invent the new technologies we need. And transportation technologies of various kinds must fundamentally accommodate to the physical realities, such as the requirement for electricity, using electricity in transportation, which I think is pretty well an essential characteristic of our future transportation system, and must account for things like power density and energy return on investment problems. But the key thing I want to emphasize here is that the shocks that we might experience in the future could create extraordinary opportunities for changing our societies and our economies and technologies. In fact, humankind's frequently don't innovate in really profound ways that change whole societies until they are in a situation that's really an emergency. But whether we're going to be able to exploit that emergency effectively is going to largely depend upon whether we're prepared in the immediate term, in the medium term, to take advantage of those crises in the future. In other words, we need to be thinking, and that's partly what the Equinox Summit is about, we need to be thinking about what we can take off the shelf and start to do when the crisis happens, when people are ready for answers, when the existing regime of energy consumption and of industries is now widely recognized to no longer be adequate and we need something new. So my model of crisis and change and innovation looks something like this. that as we go into the future, we will confront episodes which you might call shocks. This could be a climate shock, perhaps. In a few years, we run headlong into a global food crisis as a result of extreme climate events around the planet. And all of a sudden, people recognize at the highest levels of our societies, as they aren't right now, that we really need to do something about climate change. We really need to reduce our carbon output as quickly as possible. And they start to implement a global pricing regime for carbon emissions. And each one of these shocks, as they happen in the future, another might be, for instance, a war in the Middle East that closes down Middle Eastern production of oil for a period of time, and we see a very sharp rise in energy prices and oil prices, has a huge impact on our economies. Each one of these shocks creates the possibility for following different trajectories into the future, as shown by the branching within this diagram. And as we move out into the future, we make some very fundamental choices about where we're going to go. This is an idea that complexity theorists call path dependency. And as we get out towards the right-hand side of this diagram, at the end of the diagram, we actually can't go back to where we were before. We can't wind back the clock and say, oh, gee, wish we hadn't made such a big commitment to nuclear because it's turning out that it's not such a good idea. Now, that's the bad news, that there are these lock-in effects. The good news is that each one of these shocks provides what I call a moment of contingency. People are angry. They're scared. They're looking for answers. And if folks like you here and those at the Equinox Summit have developed some answers, and if they can come forward and say, take this technology, we're already researching it, it's got a high probability of being very useful because we've already thought about the needs that we're experiencing right now because we've been anticipating this crisis. If we're ready to exploit the opportunities in those ways, it's much more likely that we'll follow a positive path into the future and we're able to sustain the complexity that in many respects, from which we benefit in many ways, rather than have to face the alternative, which ultimately could be a radically reduced, a society of an economy of radically reduced complexity. And yes, complexity provides us with problems, generates problems, and creates difficulties for us in many ways, as I suggested. But overall, when you look at what it brings us, I think the alternative of a radically decomplexified economy and society is one we would not happily contemplate. So the research that's being done now to find sources of energy that can maintain that complexity in the future, the complexity that we need and that can benefit us, is of enormous importance to take advantage of these crises when they occur. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tad. You've left us with some very challenging ideas, and I'm sure many of you here in the audience have questions that you want to ask, so we'll just get this rolling. I'm going to remind you to please get the attention of Rebecca or John. They will pass you the microphone. Keep your questions concise so we can get as many fielded as possible in the next couple of minutes. Are there questions up there?
Hi, sorry. In your slide where you're talking about different GPTs, you use the example of electricity, computers, and the railroads.
Right. Internal combustion engine.
Right, sorry. My question is our system so complex now that the cost to enter in and have an innovation solution, like computers were started by hobbyists, railroads, you know, the internal combustion engine could be done by hobbyists. Is the cost to enter in and start a new system going to prevent the creation of some of the new ones we need to transition?
This is a really important question. And I you've gone to, in a sense, the heart of the ambivalence in my argument that, you know, that do we like complexity? Do we not? I mean, I don't want to go back to a world without antibiotics. And we all enjoy the benefits of the complexity we have in our energy systems, food systems, institutions. Impossible in some respects almost to quantify. On the other hand, you have to wonder at this stage whether we want to create yet more of it in the future. So, for instance, in solving our climate problem, we're going to have to develop some very complex institutions and financing mechanisms that will probably be planetary in scope. For instance, the a global carbon pricing regime is going to be, without question, is going to involve an enormous increase in complexity for human institutions. Is that something that we really think is a good thing? Overall, I think yes. I guess the direction of my argument is this, that we need to be more sophisticated and thoughtful about what kinds of complexity we introduce. And in some areas, we may want to decomplexify, in other areas, we may want to increase complexity, and maybe overall not get too much more complex, because as we do, we simply need more and more input of high-quality energy into our societies and technologies. You know, the other day I was reading that the World Wide Web and the Internet, this transfer of information around the world, is now consuming between 2 and 3% of all energy on the planet, about the equivalent of the airline industry, and it's growing way faster than anything else. Now, we sort of think of information as being sort of ethereal stuff, and it's weightless, so therefore it shouldn't be taking much energy to move it around. Well, unfortunately, these server farms are like small cities in terms of their energy consumption. In some cases, we may feel that that's a worthwhile investment. That extra complexity, that extra energy investment is a worthwhile investment for the overall return it gives us. In other places, we may say, well, we need to actually reduce our complexity and reduce our energy inputs in this segment of our technology or our economy or our society. So part of this process, it requires a kind of disaggregation of our societies, thinking in a more sophisticated way as democracies, individual members of our publics, thinking about what we want, what we don't want in the future. But the idea that we're going to steadily increase our complexity indefinitely into the future, I think, is misguided, because we're very close, I believe, to the kind of diminishing returns that Tainter has talked about in his theory.
Hi there. Do you see, in a general sense, like signs of encouragement from government and policy and and like what kind of concrete steps would you like to see taken in, say, the next 5 years towards to compensate for all of this?
Well, the most important thing, and it was mentioned in one of my slides, the most important thing is getting the prices right. Now, what right prices are, economists will always say, get the prices right. But what right means is always open to some debate. But nobody can dispute that there are huge negative externalities when it comes to exploiting our energy right now, mostly in the form of environmental externalities. And many of those costs will be borne by our children and grandchildren. So we are drawing a subsidy on our kids and our grandkids into the present to maintain our lifestyle and well-being and to maintain our complexity. So to the extent that energy becomes more expensive, especially the energy sources that we would like to use less of over time, such as carbon-based energy sources, we're going to direct innovation towards reducing the use of those forms of energy, and we'll be developing new technologies and mechanisms of conservation to change the way our economies and technologies use energy. And that could be really useful. So the most important thing, if I were the king of the world, and I said, you know, I've got one thing I can do here, the most valuable thing that would deal with both the climate issue and the oil issue simultaneously is to get a significant price on carbon.
But how are you going to get that significant price on carbon? I mean, we know the politicians aren't going to do anything until they hit one of your crises that you say, and things are muddling along just well enough that that crisis could easily be put off another 5, 10, 15 years, and the longer they put it off, the worse the crisis will obviously be.
You're absolutely right. So there are basically two answers to this. One is the argument that I developed in my last book, The Upside of Down, which is that, I made it here, that you wait for the crisis, you develop your ideas, and then you exploit the opportunity, that moment of contingency when things open up, that old ways of doing things are discredited, and you exploit that opportunity to introduce new ways of doing things. Okay, big problem there, of course, is that by the time the crisis comes, it may be too late. You're quite right. So we have to be lucky to a certain extent. It turns out that we are lucky sometimes. We were really lucky with the ozone problem. We had an ozone hole develop over the one part of the world where if you got a big hole, it didn't actually matter that much, but it scared everybody enough that they actually realized they had to do something, which is over the Antarctic. We have to hope that there are some shocks, perhaps arising, for instance, from energy shortages in the food system because of climate, perhaps of energy too, affecting the food system, and that this creates the political mobilization that allows for real change, okay? Now, the second possibility is developed by people like Ben Cashore at Yale University, and he talks about the theory of progressive incrementalism, which is the idea that you look for little changes you can make in an economy or society by introducing a new kind of technology, and you develop a constituency that's committed to that technology, and it has certain characteristics that allow it to flourish, and you exploit a path dependency. You also create a kind of tipping point in the economy overall. I'm somewhat less optimistic about that approach, because I think that the structural vested interests reinforcing the way we do things now, the status quo, are so powerful that anytime anything that's a threat to those interests becomes even at all successful, it will be marginalized in one way or the other. It will never actually get much traction. My guess is that we have to hope. I think change, innovation is punctuated in the way I described. I think we have to hope that a crisis comes, a shock of some kind that is significantly large enough to mobilize people, but not so significant that it's completely debilitating. And it needs to happen soon enough that it's not too late to deal with these challenges. But in the meantime, we've got lots to do, and that's what the Equinox Summit is about. Because if we don't have the ideas on the shelf, then we really are lost.
So, not unrelated to the previous gentleman's concerns, is a keystone area of complexity that I think hasn't been given sufficient attention, and that's the complexity of the human mind. And, you know, we're getting these negative feedbacks from our community here about the LRT, most people can understand it. Currently in Australia, with respect to charging for carbon, the Prime Minister's getting an 85% negative reaction, and I think it's because our minds are not sufficiently complex to deal with the complex reality out there, which reflects very much on our educational systems, the formal ones, the schools, universities, the informal ones, the media, and so on. They have to do a much better job in dealing with complexity. And so, in addition, there's a horror of energy, of course, and we could talk about personal energy, having high energy. So even for human beings, would you not agree that the ratio of complexity to energy is extremely important, and really we have to for humans, do we not?
Excuse me, can you just get to your question, please?
I think I know what the question is.
Okay.
So are things becoming too complex for the human mind, is one way of stating at least part of your question. It's an issue that I consider at some length in my book, The Ingenuity Gap, because I think it's a real challenge. And it goes back to the conversation we were having a few minutes ago. It goes back to my anecdote about the toilet, right? You know, if we can't understand these things, then it's actually difficult, and this is the key point. If the individual people in our democracy can't have any even basic understanding of the issues involved because things have become too complex for them to grasp, it's not just whether they could understand, but we all have so little time, right? So how much time there are people here who are obviously interested in energy issues, but how much time does your average person have to learn about thermodynamics? And yet it turns out that learning about thermodynamics is a critical part of being an informed decision maker in a democracy about how we develop solutions or energy problems, right? Among other things, you need to know that you should be using high-quality energy, thermodynamically high-quality energy, like natural gas, not to cook bitumen, which is crud, to turn it into diesel, but you should be using it for, say, petrochemical production, which is, or producing, say, electricity, which is something that would be, it's a really good use for natural gas. So there's a problem. It's not just the issues are becoming harder to understand, which they are. It's also that we all have very limited time to, cognitive time to expend on any particular slice of these problems, which means progressively that we hand over our ability to participate democratically in decision-making and decide our own future to other folks, to experts. And it's extremely dangerous. So what's my agenda here? My agenda is an educational agenda. Is to say, you know, you actually need to understand something about complexity and thermodynamic openness and marginal returns on complexity and the energy return on investment if you're going to participate in reasonable decision making within the society.
And last question.
So I have a question about your measurement of ERI for planning purposes, specifically for policymakers. So it's twofold. First, how easy is it to make a complex system to a lesser complex system? And then, is there an evaluation framework that you can apply constantly to make sure that if your complex system is not going crazy?
Okay. Lots of big issues there. One thing I thought you were going to ask about, and it's kind of implicit in your questions, is this metric, the energy return on investment metric, is actually very hard in some respects to calculate for any technology, precisely because any energy system, being a complex system, like the petroleum industry or the nuclear industry, is itself thermodynamically open. And where you draw the line around it to say, okay, this is the stuff, the energy inputs that we're going to count against the energy production of this industry is not clear at all. There's always a problem of bounding the system to decide, okay, everything inside this line we're going to count as an energy investment towards producing energy in that industry, and everything outside we're not. And people do their best, but they have to make a series of sometimes fairly heroic assumptions to decide on the boundary. Now, your first question was, can you just repeat?
Yes, it's with regards to if you know that your complex system is
out of.
Repeat that, please.
So the question was, if you know that your complex system is quite out of whack, if there's a way to reduce it to a lower.
Right, it's a decomplexification issue, right? Yeah. Reducing complexity voluntarily is something we're not very good at. Usually because we're either benefiting directly from the complexity or there's some groups and individuals whose status and authority, perhaps there's wealth, their wealth is wrapped up with that particular complex system, technology, economic system, or whatever. There have been a few occasions in history where we've seen decomplexification, deliberate. Interestingly enough, one of the ones that Joe Tainter talks about is the Roman Empire, the Western and Eastern Roman Empires. The Western Roman Empire ran into an energy return on investment ceiling, according to him, and simply couldn't provide sufficient energy to maintain its complexity and collapsed. The Eastern Roman Empire recognized it had a challenge and radically simplified its internal organization, including its defense along its perimeter. It's one of the only examples in history where people have gone through that kind of exercise and it survived for another millennium. I think, though, in general answer to your question in terms of our own lives today, we need to put the simplification option on the table, and it goes back to the original question. To the extent that we can disaggregate the problem and say, okay, these parts of society or the economy, and these technologies we can simplify, and these ones we have to have more complex to deal with the challenges we're facing, then we're going to have a more variegated response. and a more appropriate response. And it might actually be easier to accept certain simplifications in some parts of our society if we know that it doesn't mean simplification overall of everything, which would quite possibly be catastrophic.
Okay. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your excellent questions this afternoon. And please join me in thanking Dr. Thomas Homer Dixon. This concludes our public lecture this afternoon. Please watch for the agenda later tonight on TVO and WGSI.org. And as we wrap up and move outside, please note that Wordsworth Books is set up, and if you're looking for a Thomas Homer Dixon book, you'll find it there. Good afternoon.